Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on WNRN. The Wake-Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. The Wake-Up Call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
And good morning, everybody. Happy Sunday. Goodness gracious, it's a nice day outside, isn't it? Thank you so much for tuning in, and special thanks to those at Harrisonburg's 95.1, and not just to them, but everybody who listens to the Wake Up Call on WNRN. It's always a nice thank you to you for allowing us to be here. We're going to be talking about politics today, and sort of my thing about there's got to be a way to improve politics, the way it's done, the way it's run, the way it's the money that goes into it and out of it. And so I invited two guests on today to tell me whether any of that is right or all of it is right, which is my hope, and to talk about suggestions and ways that may or may not work that are always out there. Our guest today, we'll start over here closest to the door, Professor Paul Friedman. Paul, how are you?
Good. Good to be here, Rick.
And thank you for joining us. Professor Friedman from UVA Department of Politics and also an election analyst for ABC News. For some reason, I thought only Larry Sabato did that.
I got special permission.
Good to know. Also in the studio today, Professor Jeffrey Jenkins from UVA Department of Politics and faculty at the Miller Center of Public Affairs. Professor.
Thanks, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
All right, so we are going to talk about politics. Write down the phone number. We'll take some calls later in the hour if you'd like to join in. 979-0919. And then if you're a little further out, it's 877-WNRN-ROCKS. That's 877-967-6762. I was asked a couple times, and I think in an email from one of our guests, sort of suggested that maybe you got this from, what's the gentleman from Washington Post, Ezra?
Klein. Ezra Klein.
Ezra Klein. If I'd read that. Actually, my interest in this topic popped up back in April. I read something from Bill Moyers. I'm going to quote that now. What we have is much closer to plutocracy, where the massive concentration of wealth at the top protects and perpetuates itself by controlling the ends and means of politics. This is why so many of us despair over fixing what's wrong. We elect representatives to change things, and then once in office, they wind up serving the deep-pocketed donors who put up the money to keep change from happening at all. And I read that in a piece that he had written, and it sort of struck me directly as to why I was gasping and moaning at why I felt things were so wrong in our system. I certainly fall into the large minority of, I don't know if it's in the high 80s or actually 90% of polled individuals who think that this is the, who are unhappy with the Senate and the House of Representatives. Real quick, Professor Friedman, Professor Jenkins, any sort of feeling as to whether that's an accurate or an inaccurate comment from Bill Moyers?
Well, I think that money in politics has always been in our system. We've been trying to, at the national level and at the state and local level, trying to use laws, use statutes ever since the early part of the 20th century to try to limit donations and influence in our electoral system, to varying degrees. I guess I would be one of the, and we've spoken about this before, I'd be perhaps a devil's advocate and start with, is the system itself actually broken? How would we know if it's broken? What should it look like? What will we expect it to look like if it were working well or working efficiently? It could very well be that we have the system that we deserve as an American public. To the extent that, and there are different views on this in the political science literature. One is that citizens have become very polarized in the mass public, citizens, voters, and our representatives in the House and the Senate are simply reflecting what the underlying citizenry wants. So to the extent that there is the lack of civility in Congress today, to the extent that there is a there isn't much deference for things like compromise and negotiated settlements and trying to get along and trying to pass things and finding common ground. There was one strain of thought that suggests that the American public, the voters who elect these representatives to Congress, don't want that. They want ideologically pure representatives to stand for what they want, and compromise is not one of those things.
Yeah, let me add to that by saying, first, we've got a system that was designed to be resistant to change. And so to the extent that we have perennial frustration with the problems that we see, with the challenges we face, this is something that was built into the system from the very start. Second thing is, by its very nature, democracy will produce winners and losers, which means that there will always be one group of people who is stymied, stifled, frustrated, and even angry, at least one group. And so that these two features together mean that we will inherently and inevitably have some sort of underlying baseline tension, frustration, with the way things are. Now, having said that, Rick, I want to suggest that indeed we know beyond any doubt that money plays a huge role in politics, in elections, and that if anything, it's becoming more concentrated. And just as we've seen a disparities and growing inequalities in wealth and income across the board, we've seen similar trends in campaign contributions. We know there's a recent Sunlight Foundation report that found 24%, more than 24%, almost a quarter of all contributions in the 2010 electoral cycle to PACs, to organizations, to candidates and parties, came from not the top 1%, but the top 0.1%. A relative sliver, a fraction of the American population that is contributing almost a quarter of all campaign contributions. Money in politics is concentrated, and it's at a huge level, particularly in the wake of the Supreme Court Citizens United case. We see a huge increase in the role of outside interest groups outside of the parties and the candidates who are playing really just a tremendous role in this election cycle.
Professor Paul Friedman from UVA's Department of Politics. We also have Professor Jeff Jenkins from Department of Politics. So, Professor Jenkins, is the system broken? I mean, your question sort of said, how would we know, which makes me wonder if there is a true opinion as to yes, it is, or no, it isn't, but more of just a question about, well, maybe it is and maybe it isn't, but we just don't know.
So what do we know? We know, as a political science community, there is no disagreement on the notion that Congress is highly polarized, that the degree of difference between Republicans and Democrats is at an all-time high in our system. So there's no disagreement about that. Everyone, based on any number of ways to kind of look at data, comes to that conclusion. One of the things where there is disagreement on is, do we see that level of polarization at the mass level among citizens, among ordinary voters? There are a couple schools of thought on that. One is that the same level of polarization that we see in Congress is evident in the American public. And if that's the case, then the system isn't broken. Right? Our representatives are simply reflecting what the underlying citizenry wants. Another opinion is that citizens have polarized a bit. So ordinary Republicans and ordinary Democrats have divided a bit over time, say in the last 30 years. But nothing like what we see in Congress. So Congress is several steps removed from what's going on in the mass public. If that's the case, then you can make an argument for a broken system, right? Our representatives are acting in a much more extreme way than citizens would like. And then the question is why? And we can discuss that. There are various reasons for that.
But there's another question, Jeff, and that is, given the level of polarization within Congress that we observe, what are the implications? What does it mean for policymaking? And Rick mentioned the Ezra Klein Washington Post article, and Klein notes, as many have, that in fact this Congress, the 112th Congress, has done less than many of its predecessors. And whether or not that's attributable to polarization or to something else, Klein notes that in terms of sheer number of bills that have been passed, this Congress has done considerably less than pretty much any other. Is that a problem, and is that something that is worth addressing? I'd note that Klein goes on to observe public opinion approval ratings for Congress, which are never particularly high, but they are now particularly low. In last fall, in a New York Times CBS poll, Congress's approval rating among the American population was 9%, which was just about the approval rating of Hugo Chavez, and considerably lower than approval ratings for the IRS, and even for Nixon during Watergate, which, according to Klein, Nixon had a 24% approval rating. The only figure, according to Klein, who rates lower than Congress is Fidel Castro, who was at 5% as opposed to Congress's 9%.
I found that hysterical. Actually, I chuckled at that when I saw that online, talking about potential ways to improve our political system if it's needed to be improved or changed in any way. Guests today, Professor Jeff Jenkins and Professor Paul Friedman from University of Virginia.
Just on some of Paul's points, it's not clear that a rough count of laws is good. I mean, I think there would be a lot of people in society to say that, you know, a Congress that passes a lot of laws may not be the best Congress, especially if those laws don't reflect upon my interest. Right. So that's potentially misleading. I think one way to think about it, so if Congress is polarizing, if there's a great deal of polarization between Republicans and Democrats, what's one consequence? Well, what we observe, say, over the last decade or so, is that most of the major laws that are getting produced, most of the major laws that are being written, are being written within the majority party. Right. So members of the minority party aren't privy to what's actually going on when the laws are being written, right? So this is a potential concern, right? And, you know, so 30, 40 years ago, there was bipartisan action on the actual creation of law. Today, the majority party writes the law. So one concern is, well, if you have everybody in the room who kind of sees the world the same way, and there isn't any differing opinion, potentially you might not have the best law that could be written, right? There might not be people in the room who might say, wait a minute, what about this provision, right? You may not actually be observing some of the things that you should be observing, right? If it's an echo chamber, right, we may not have the sort of opinions that we may need to write the best law, the best quality law possible. That's a concern.
Go ahead.
You know, the public opinion stuff is funny, right? I think we both laugh about this kind of thing. Congress is not popular. And one question is why. There's always been this kind of this paradox, right? If you ask citizens about their individual representative, they tend to like that individual representative, right? When they're asked about Congress as a whole, they don't particularly like Congress. Certainly, this is an all-time low. This is really low.
Yeah.
But when those citizens are picking up the paper and they're reading media reports about the broken branch, right, they're already getting in their head that the system is broken. And when they're asked about Congress, they respond in a like-minded manner. So,
right, you don't favor things that are broken.
Well,
unless it's the old car.
That's true.
That you just can't bear to get rid of.
That's true. So if the media is priming people to already think that the system is broken, potentially you would get results maybe like this a bit.
11:13 here on the wake-up call with our guests, Professors Paul Friedman and Jeff Jenkins from UVA's Department of Politics. Let me thank Herb Bennett. He's from the Anthem Blue Cross and Blue Shield authorized agent. He's the local agent in Central Virginia. Herb provides expert knowledge and personal service in designing your individual health insurance plan. Your health is worth protecting, and you should not let it go uninsured. For a quote, you can give Agent Herb Bennett a call at 855-425-0090. Or you can visit agentherb.com. Back with our guests talking about political system. Professor Friedman.
So let me just respond to a couple of things that Jeff says, because I think he's absolutely right. Just because the public thinks something's broken doesn't mean that it's broken. Just because the public disapproves of something, that doesn't mean that that it's worthy of disapproval, or certainly worthy of this level of disapproval. And we know from public opinion data that regularly people hold views that are changing, that are ill-informed, that are inconsistent, even internally inconsistent. So that public opinion is not necessarily evidence in and of itself that Congress, in fact, is broken. Similarly, I think Jeff is absolutely correct that public opinion is extremely reflective of media coverage, media frames, and indeed, as media collectively report on the broken branch, I think that it's extremely plausible that that this gets reflected in public opinion. However, I suspect that there's more going on than the idea that Congress is working perfectly. The public has been duped by a media that is conspiring to present the branch as broken. I think that it's not a coincidence that Congress is doing that. This Congress is doing less than almost all of its predecessors. That there is, I'm skeptical that a high level of polarization is in and of itself an indication of something broken. But I think collectively there's reason to suspect a disconnect between at least expectations for what we would want our national legislative body to do and what we've seen. I think it's reasonable to begin to ask how can we bridge that disconnect.
Well, whether or not you choose to use the word broken, I would expect that there is a majority who would say that the branch, even if we focus on the one branch, and certainly there are three overall, we seem to be focused on the legislative at the moment, even if it's not broken, there is room for improvement. There's room for greater efficiency. Is that true? Both seem to be nodding your heads, although the determination of broken may not have been...
Right, and there are also clearly policy issues that need to be addressed in some sustained and serious manner, whether it's infrastructure, energy needs, climate change. There are things that, and certainly healthcare, that have been on the agenda, need to be on the agenda, and need to be addressed in serious ways that I think there are obstacles to taking place.
All right, 11:17. I see the phone ringing, but we're going to let it go for a minute. We'll, after our first break, we'll answer the phone, but let's let our guests get a few comments in. We are talking about potential ways to improve the political system here. Professor Jeff Jenkins and Paul Friedman from UVA. Gentlemen, have we brought any of this upon ourselves? You talk about the polarization and whether or not that's representative of the citizenship. In 2008, there was a big run towards the Democrats. And then in 2010, there's a sort of a vast swing back towards the Republican. Without some sort of middle-of-the-road flow representing the ability to communicate well, and is this, are we sending, pushing this information out to those in Washington, D.C., is we can't make up our mind, and this year we want this, and 2 years from now we want this? Or is this coming down from Washington, D.C. towards the voters?
It's a good question.
I'm trying to be full of at least one or two of those every hour.
That's a very good question. As political scientists, we struggle with these sorts of questions, right? Is it bottom up or is it top down? And the truth is probably somewhere in between, right? There's probably some top down effect. There's probably some bottom up effect. In elections, in the sorts of elections that you mentioned, right, 2008, 2010, we could talk about all kinds of things related to polarization. But what we know about elections, some of the things that we know about elections, is that there are really big structural issues in elections. And when the economy is not doing well, when unemployment is high, right, the president's party is typically punished. And we saw that in 2008, and we saw that in 2010. And I think the Democrats are worried about that in 2012, right, with unemployment still above 8% and very unlikely to come down below 8%. President Obama might do everything he can to try to reveal things about Governor Romney's record. But those sorts of structural, we have models to suggest those sorts of structural problems are going to be evident, right? So when we think about what's going to happen, we need to be very focused on what's happening in Virginia and what's happening in North Carolina and some of those swing states that President Obama won in 2008.
A quick question, because I think, Professor Jenkins, you went back, you used the phrase echo chamber. So to avoid polarization, do we have the legislative and presidential branch be one political party so that work can be accomplished, but potentially in an echo chamber? Or do we have different parties represented in those two areas, but potentially not get anything accomplished?
That's a good question, right? So affordable
two
care.
Two in a row.
The Affordable Care Act, right? It's the target of so much antipathy today. Right? Affordable Care passed in the House and the Senate without a single Republican vote. When we look at, you know, very important pieces of legislation historically, landmark legislation historically, when we think about Social Security, when we think about Medicare, those had substantial buy-ins from both parties historically. So that's something that's very different about today's society, right? So when we whether that's an indication of it being broken or not, we see major pieces of legislation being passed wholly within a majority party. So Affordable Care only got passed because the Democrats had 60 votes in the Senate initially. They could get through the filibuster in that way, and they needed every one of
right,
those 60 Democratic votes.
Right, because 59 is no longer a majority for some purpose.
That's right. So one of the reforms potentially we can think about is what to do about the minority party using the filibuster in the Senate pretty much on any policy that comes up. Right, historically, the filibuster was used on only the most important pieces of policy from the minority's perspective. Only those pieces of policy.
The notes that I have are the filibuster was used 35 times in 50 years, and then it's been used 100 times in the last 2 years.
Yeah, so the majority party knows that before they start down the road on any kind of policy matter, they know that they probably will need to have 60 votes. And is that a good thing for our society?
All right. It is 11:21 on the wake-up call, talking about politics. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back into suggested ways to improve the political system. We'll open up the phone lines. Our guests today, Paul Friedman and Jeff Jenkins from UVA's Department of Politics. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Cloudy with patchy fog throughout some of the day today. Partly sunny, 20% chance of showers in Lynchburg and Richmond, highs in the low 80s. Mostly cloudy, 20% chance of showers in Lynchburg tonight, 65 to 70. And then partly sunny with, again, small chance of showers tomorrow, highs in the 90s. Right now, it's a nice day outside, some clouds around the area, 72 in the valley, 70 in Lynchburg, 75 in Richmond, 69 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support, celebrating 40 years as your local one-stop source for outdoor gear, apparel, and footwear. As the heat of summer settles in, you can stay cool with Blue Ridge's selection of quick-dry shirts, board shorts, sandals, and flip-flops. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports is at Barracks Road in Charlottesville and at two locations in Richmond. For more store information, it's brms.com. All right, we got a caller, and it's Bonnie from Albemarle. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello. This is my comment to improve our political system. First, term limits on all elected representatives. Second, flat tax of 10% for all levels of society, including that 0.1%. And third, complete financial transparency. I think that's what needs to happen in order to have things more equal across the board.
Bonnie, quick question for you. When you say transparency, who are you talking about for with that? Because if you're talking about
the president and Congress, are you also talking about all citizenship?
Yeah, right down to our county elected representatives. I think that it's time for anybody who is going to run for public office to show how much they earn and what they earn. And, you know, it would also be nice for people who are not so wealthy to be able to run, because they might have some really good ideas that are not available to the general public because they're, you know, stuck in a cage of financial woe, and they may have something to offer. So that's where the flat tax comes in. So if you flat tax everybody, then we've got a little, you know, if you make a dollar, 10 cents on the dollar. You know, if you make $1 million, $100,000. And I think that would certainly even up the playing field. And I do not care for the PACs. I think that they are outrageous lies. Like, I'm not necessarily for Romney, but when I see the Romney ad that comes on where he's saying, we're going to get rid of Planned Parenthood, I look at the motions of his mouth, and I'm wondering, has the media dubbed him? You know, and the same thing goes for the Obama ads. Have the media moguls dubbed the speech? Because I know they can pick up pieces of words and put them in a mouth, and it makes it look like they're saying what they're saying. But I'm not so sure about that. So flat tax, financial transparency, and term limits. Term limits I could get into more, but...
All right, Bonnie. Well, let's let the guests get into that. Thanks for the call and the points.
Sure. Bye-bye.
I'll say, Bonnie, this is Paul Friedman. Bonnie raises a number of highlights, and in terms of the sorts of reforms that have been put on the table, certainly economic reforms, election reforms, and reforms dealing with sunlight, sunshine, and transparency are three big sets of proposals. Term limits is a big one, and term limits has been on the table in various forms for at least 20 years, both at the national level and at state and local levels. The Supreme Court has taken it off the table with respect to federal elections. And I think there's another response to these proposals, and that is to note that in a meaningful way, we already have term limits, and they're called elections. And if I don't like the job that you're doing as my legislator, I can vote against you, and if I get enough people to vote against you and find another candidate, you're out of office. Similarly, if you're somebody who feels that the appropriate way to go about being in office is to impose a term limit on yourself, you're free to do that. Many people have here, of course, in Virginia. We've got a Senate election that is the result of a self-imposed term limit of one term by our Democratic Senator Jim Webb. And so I think to the extent that term limits would serve to take electoral choices off the table, I think that they are fundamentally anti-democratic, and we should let the democratic electoral process work as it was intended.
Yeah, I think that's right. Term limits were sexy back in the 90s, and a number of state legislatures adopted term limits. So we actually, we have a laboratory as a political scientist to study this a bit, and it's a mixed bag. What we observe is that one of the nice things about a system in which there are no term limits is that members of a legislature have to be responsive to their constituents. And once you take that off the table, once you term limit those representatives, then they start to think about, well, what am I going to do when my job is over? And they begin to think about maybe the next elected office or the next appointed office. And term limits also have a negative side in that they sort out of office very capable, very experienced politicians, right? And one of the things that's instrumental in producing good law is having people who know what they're doing, right? Who possess that sort of experience and knowledge. And term limits would essentially sort them out. It would move them out of office.
It's a very complex system with a lot of minutiae involved, and sometimes it takes many years to learn what exactly. all the minutiae is.
That's exactly
and
right.
And one of the unintended consequences, therefore, of term limits is that you shift the center of gravity, if you will, the repository, the institutional memory, the knowledge of all the minutiae, Rick, that you're talking about, to unelected actors, so staff members, lobbyists, other political types who are completely unaccountable
and
to
behind,
voters.
And what's the... behind the curtains,
exactly,
is the Wizard of Oz-ish thing where
right, and if we didn't elect the wizard, we ought to be concerned about transferring more power to the wizard.
11:29 on the Wake Up Call. Our guest today, Professor Paul Friedman and Professor Jeff Jenkins from UVA. We're talking about ways, if needed, to improve the political system. We're taking calls now. Thanks, Bonnie, for getting that started. 979-0919 and 877. WNRN Rocks. That's 877-967-6762. Let me take a moment and thank Dixon Disposal for allowing us to be here today. When Dixon picks up your trash, they sort and separate it for recycling. Dixon offers a single stream recycling during the regular pickup. You can help the planet stay green with curbside service from Dixon Disposal at your home or business. For more information, it's DixonDisposal.com or call them 434-978-2111. I'm back with our guests, and you're welcome to call in and be a guest by phone with your question or comment. Again, 979-0919 for the local folks, 877-967-6762 if you're a little further out. Guys, we're talking about term limits, but one of my complaints about term limits is it's so much easier to stay in office, and I believe that's been proven, not necessarily because you're doing a good job, but because of your name and because of the opportunity to fundraise. And I've always been a believer that you should only be allowed to spend X amount of money, or you should only be allowed to spend so much time actually fundraising. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, it doesn't matter which side you believe is doing right or wrong, you can identify, and I happen to remember Nancy Pelosi because it was in a 60 Minutes piece, I think, where she actually participated in more fundraisers than there were days in the year because she was going to so many in a particular day. And it seems unfair not only to the people that you may be running against, but also to the people who you are theoretically supporting when you are spending so much time supporting yourself than you are supporting your constituency.
Yeah, it's almost like an arms race, right? I mean, in order to stay in office, members of Congress have to spend more and more time fundraising. And it just continues to escalate. It continues to just, you know, wave up. And it wouldn't surprise me in, you know, so if I were to make some kind of prediction today, right, it wouldn't surprise me that in, I don't know, in the next few years, you might actually see members of both the Republican and Democratic Party adopt some sort of law that would place limits, that would place caps on fundraising and campaign finance, simply because it takes so much energy on their part, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, to be able to continue to raise and raise and raise and raise. I think the individual members of Congress would probably prefer to be able to spend more time legislating if they could. But individually, right, they can't afford not to.
Right, right. In 2008, the candidates, the parties, interest groups spent well over $1 billion, $1.6 billion, just in the presidential election. And it was closer to $5 billion if you include House and Senate races, gubernatorial races. We're spending a lot of money. What is shifting is not only the amount of money, but the sources of money. And we've talked, and maybe we'll talk a bit more about the role of outside groups in recent years. As of July 22nd, 2008, outside groups and parties, not the candidates themselves, but just PACs and interest groups and the party committees, had spent $90 million at this point. As of July 22nd this year, PACs, interest groups, and parties have spent $202 million. So it's more than double in just the last 4 years.
All right, we got a couple callers. We're going to take them in order. So I'm going to talk to Joe first. So, Melvin, you need to hang on. And hey, Joe, how are you?
I'm doing all right, yourself.
All right, we got Joe from Richmond. Question or comment?
Question. I'd like to define myself as a moderate, and one of the things that you guys were talking about is how everybody seems to be so polarized with the current situations. And one of the, I guess my question is, when you talk to a lot of these people, when they're talking about the opposing party, it doesn't matter what the idea is, it's just a horrible idea as long as the other party did it. And there seems to be almost like a principled animosity towards the other party, and they just don't want to come to the table and listen. As a moderate, I kind of view that both parties are going to have their ups and downs, and you have to take them for what they're worth. The country, how do we get out of this state? Unfortunately, sort of like a national tragedy, what would be something that could unify us so we would start coming back to the table and, you know, working on good ideas versus just constant animosity towards each other and not even allowing ideas to flow?
Gentlemen?
Good question.
Thanks, Joe.
Of course, we have just had a national tragedy, and I think Joe is right to suggest that there are moments in the wake of a tragedy, like we've seen in Colorado, in which we are more apt to at least put aside temporarily, perhaps, some of what motivates us to be more polarized. That is almost surely going to be very short-lived. We'll be back to Jeff mentioned the swing states, and he's absolutely right to say that in the context of a presidential election, that's all that matters. That's not where most of the action is. It's where all of the action is. Colorado is a swing state, and both candidates will be back on the airwaves soon enough, making their strong claims about themselves and about their opponents. Let me note that, like Joe, I think what we see at the presidential election level, believe it or not, is a campaign that pits two people who are relative moderates relative to their own parties. And in fact, we have in Mitt Romney a candidate whom was accused of being too moderate to be the Republican standard bearer. And many people from across the spectrum see Barack Obama as essentially a political centrist.
So let me tell you a quick story about how we got here, right? That might answer Joe's question. Why do we potentially see the polarization that we do? And why, when we take a look at members of Congress, why are all the moderates gone, right? If we look 30 or 40 years ago, there are lots of moderates in Congress. When we look today, there's a handful at most. And the story that's typically told is that in the 50s and 60s, the political parties changed, right? The parties had been machine-based parties, right, where individuals who went off, the party managers went off, and they're there to essentially get jobs, right? They are kind of moderate in what they do. There were reforms, right? We were talking about reforms, right? So the reforms, we didn't like party machines at that time, right? The reforms got rid of them, but it left open this vacuum, right? And into the vacuum came a bunch of interest groups, right? Interest groups on the left, interest groups on the right. And those interest groups suddenly saw a great position for themselves to be politically active. And the receptacle for their action were the primaries, right? So in today's world, right, the turnout, electoral turnout in primary elections for Congress is typically low double digits or high single digits. And the individuals who come out and vote in those primaries are the individuals who care deeply about politics. And those individuals are typically people with extreme perspectives, right? Leftist perspectives for the Democrats, rightist perspectives for the Republicans. So in order to win, in order to get to the general election as a candidate, you got to get through the primaries. In order to win a primary election, you got to deal with the primary electorate. And those primary electorates are pretty conservative or liberal, right? So you got to reach out to those people. You got to show them your bona fides. So one way to perhaps fix the system and get back to a system in which maybe we do care about moderate positions and moderate policies and maybe have more moderate politicians is for more Americans to actually care about turning out and participating in primaries. If that's the case, then we might actually have candidates who try to appeal to those moderate voters.
All right, let's take our call. Melman, did you hang with me?
Yes, sir. Good morning. How are you guys doing?
It's a good start to the day. Question or comment for our guests?
A little bit of both. First, I want to make a comment that I am a staunch supporter of term limits, but your gentleman had articulated some very well points that I'm not so much as reconsidering that position, but I am taking into consideration as far as how anti-democratic it can be. And one question I do want to ask, and they can answer it after I make another comment, is I do want to find out how is anti-democratic for us to have to impose term limits on congressional officials, even though we impose a term limit on our president. Can't remember what amendment it is, but we do actually have a term limit on that aspect. And also,
all right, Melvin, you're breaking up. So I thank you for hanging on as long as you did to get that point across. That makes both phone lines open now, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Our guest today as we talk about improving politics, Professor Paul Friedman and Professor Jeff Jenkins. So, and Professor Friedman, I think that was you who said it wasn't democratic to put the term limit out there. And Melvin says, well, we do it for the president.
Right, and that's a good point. And, of course, let me simply emphasize that by undemocratic, I mean with a small d, not with a capital D. And only in the sense that it, I think, pushes against and works against the logic of congressional and presidential elections. And I would say that the reason it is acceptable at the presidential level is it's in the Constitution. It's not just at the presidential level. Many states, including right here in Virginia, have a gubernatorial term limit. Our governor, as most listeners know, serves only a single term. And what that means is that from day one, the governor is a lame duck. From day one, there is a complete lack of the next election looming, which we think, if we think that elections serve to hold representatives and elected officials accountable, if we think that elections do a good job of keeping elected officials in check because they are concerned about the response of voters at the polls in the next elections, then I think we should, in fact, be concerned about removing that right off the bat in every case.
So it would be allowable to impose term limits if it was voted on by the public as a whole or by the folks who are, and put it in as a constitutional amendment.
Exactly. The Supreme Court has essentially ruled that the only way for term limits at the federal level to be constitutional is to put them into the Constitution by way of a constitutional amendment. That's something that is extremely unlikely to happen.
So, very quick story on the constitutional amendment vis-a-vis the presidency. So, that constitutional amendment was passed in a Republican government, right? The Republicans had been out of power in the Congress for a generation. Just after World War II, they captured both the House and the Senate, and they saw an opportunity to prevent another situation where you might have a Democratic president like FDR win four elections in a row, and they took it. Politics is always there. We don't have to talk about today. We can talk about 7 years ago.
Right.
11:42 on the wake-up call. Call in with your question or comment if you'd like for our guests, Professors Jeff Jenkins and Paul Friedman.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Market for Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news, on newsstands Thursday. Here's Rick on what you can find on this week's Hook.
Oh, for more than three decades, the cookie lady of Afton Mountain delighted long-distance bikes with her southern hospitality and plate of sweet treats. Her death at age 91 has bikers mourning their trail angel. The Hook reports on the unexplained death of Faye Tinsley and a judge's ruling that a Fluvanna High School player bit an opponent. And a UVA psychology professor explains the secret to healthy living and overcoming life's obstacles. The Hook. News in print every week. News online every day. And today's programming on WNRN brought to you by Blue Ridge Graphics. You can find them Mead Avenue at East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, online BRG t-shirts. LesTempest.com. And not that you would, but don't go anywhere, because at noon, Drew Thompson is here for Les Temps Purdue. That's the best of 80s and 90s alternative music. Drew brings out the roots of alternative, because you can't understand where we are without first knowing where we've been. Take a trip back to the times gone by with Les Temps Purdue, only on WNRN. Okay, back with our guests today, Professors Friedman and Jenkins. Firing up the phone lines a little bit. I see it's lit up again. 979-0919, 877-WNRN rocks. Well, let's talk a little bit about gerrymandering, because I think we touched on, once you're in office, it's easier to stay in office. I don't think that's anything new to those who do any reading in the newspaper or online or elsewhere. Helping yourself stay in office. Is there a way, is that something that needs to be changed? Is that a problem in the system? And if so, what is the method used to change it?
What we're observing in terms of gerrymandering, so there's research to suggest that gerrymandering isn't related to polarization. So if we try to attack, if we're concerned about a too polarized Congress, dealing with gerrymandering isn't the problem. What's interesting about gerrymandering is that increasingly it's a bipartisan effort, right? So we talk about wanting more bipartisanship, and one of the things that incumbents, whether Republicans and Democrats, like is that they like staying in office.
Hold on a sec. Is that true?
Yes.
I mean, bipartisan, but isn't it only bipartisan because both people do it when it's their year in office, when it happens?
The majority party will try to use its leverage to ensure that it can either maintain the number of seats that it has in a given state or win some new ones. But oftentimes it works in concert with sitting Democrats, right? So the minority party will try to protect its members as well. And inevitably what we see is that incumbents will, try to join together to prevent, you know, anyone from getting knocked out of office.
And Jeff, just to clarify, you're talking about what's going on at the state level in response to the decennial census, redrawing districts both for the House of Representatives and state legislative bodies as well. So this is something that goes on in every state. It goes on a regular basis, and it has profound implications for what vote margins look like in congressional districts. An important point here is I think many citizens think that what state legislators do may not be of great significance or even worth paying much attention to when it comes to what happens in Congress. And I think that the process of redistricting is one instance. If we needed a reminder that state politics matters, this is a very strong reminder.
One thing that's changed maybe in the last 10 or 20 years is that if a new majority party comes in the state legislature, they don't wait for a new census to redraw lines.
Right.
So Tom DeLay did this in Texas, right? And he faced a lot of heat for doing this, right? So midway between an old and a new census, the Republicans came to power in Texas, and DeLay didn't wait, right? He immediately tried to redraw lines, and he was successful largely in doing that.
Rick Moore here on the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call. Thanks for joining us. It's 11:47 as we talk about is there a broken part of politics, and if so, suggestions on how to fix it. You're welcome to call. 979-0919 is the local number. How about, let's go back. I want to talk about some of the parliamentary procedures. We mentioned the filibuster, and I want to get to that in just a moment, but what about the what are called clean bills, no earmarks, et cetera, so that you are actually voting for the main topic at hand and not voting for something that you disapprove of and then be called on it later or et cetera?
This is your area, man.
what's interesting is that earmarks are really just a small percentage of the federal budget, right? It's one of those areas that media has jumped on, right? And oftentimes the earmarks themselves lead to very positive things for communities, right? They produce positive things for districts, for communities. And it has become one of those little pieces of grease that helps, you know, kind of make things happen. I'm not particularly so concerned about the earmark problem. You know, I mean, I think there are, so if, you know, so for example, a filibuster is one that's much bigger, or is a much bigger concern, right? To the extent that you actually need 60 votes today, right? That you could have a majority party that has 58 votes, right? In the Senate, and it can't get things done, right? 58% of the chamber wants to move in a certain direction, or 59% wants to move in a certain direction. And the rules are such, right? The filibuster is an anti-democratic rule. And it's a real problem. It's grown to become a real problem.
So it sounds like that you believe, Professor Jenkins, that there should be something done about it. Professor Friedman, what are the ways to fix the problem?
Well, let me ask my colleague Jeff whether he thinks it would help if congressional leaders, Senate leaders, actually required people to conduct a filibuster.
Sure. So, you know, we have kind of de facto filibusters today, right, where leaders will go around and ask people if they have any opposition to a bill. They don't actually have to, you know, when we think about the filibuster, we often think about Mr. Smith goes to Washington,
yeah,
right, or what we, you know, in our history books when we think about the filibusters in the 1960s on civil rights, where members of the opposition actually had to hold the floor formally, right? So they had to get their, you know, they had to get their pajamas out and move their cots into the aisles and make sure that there was someone there present for these, you know, these round the clock sessions. That doesn't exist anymore, right? So an individual can simply say, you know, I'm going to place a hold on this bill, right? I am going to oppose this bill, and they don't have to actually work toward, you know, doing the hard work of maintaining the filibuster. Yeah, I think that would be an additional cost on members of the minority.
Exactly, and it would be fun to watch.
And it would be fun to watch.
But how,
right?
Do you change it? How did it go from the status of Mr. Smith goes to Washington and the way it was done there, where you had to hold the floor, to what it is now? What changed? What allowed that ripple to go from one to the other? And how do you get it to flow back the other way to where it is, and to where it's not just a stymie of making things happen?
Yeah, the Senate is kind of a funky institution. It has always been sort of a funky institution.
We started the conversation with that.
So, over time, the Senate, among other things, runs on a sort of a deference between the majority party and the minority party. Unless the majority party has 60 votes or more than 60 votes, and historically it hasn't, the minority party has very strong rights, very strong minority rights in the Senate. And over time, as the parties have polarized, right, the minority party has pushed the envelope on those rights. It used to be the case that the filibuster, again, I think I mentioned this earlier, filibuster would only be used on sort of these very high-profile issues that the minority party deeply cared about. That's changed. The norm around which a filibuster will be used has changed, right? The minority now sees it, minority party leaders now see it as fair game, pretty much on almost any issue. And unless the majority party does something to make sure that that doesn't happen, I don't see any change happening, right? There was a movement a couple of years ago under the Republicans, the so-called nuclear option, whereby there would be a movement toward a more majoritarian system, right? A system in which you only needed majority rule. You only needed 50% plus one in order to get things done. And a small group of Democrats and a small group of Republicans in a bipartisan effort got together and prevented that from happening. And what you had is people on both sides, right? John McCain was a big player in this at the time. What you had was members of both sides being very worried, right? They don't like the filibuster when they're in the majority. But they see down the line and they say, well, at some point we're going to be in the minority. And when we're in the minority, we want to make sure that we have a strong filibuster present.
So Jeff makes a really important point, Rick, and that is for any proposed reform. And we've talked about some big ones, term limits, the filibuster, other rules changes, but there's others on the table. I mean, people talk about reconfiguring the primary calendar and the primary process. People talk about abolishing the Electoral College altogether. People talk about public financing for elections. People talk about other constitutional amendments like a balanced budget amendment, which would force the government to produce a balanced budget. We need to remember that all reforms, all proposals for change involve winners and losers, involve a clash of values, and involve both intended and unintended consequences.
Let me mention one reform that I'd like to see. And this is something that probably doesn't get as much attention in the media as it deserves. Since about the mid-1990s, Congress has returned to session after the November elections, right, in what's called a lame duck session. So when Congress reconvenes after the November elections for a couple of weeks and sometimes as much as a month, you have members of Congress there who have lost their reelection bid or retired from Congress, and they're still allowed to vote. And what leaders have used this lame duck session to do is essentially kick bills that are tough to pass, that are going to provide some difficulties for members who are going to be running in November until after the election. And it's a degree of cowardice. Right? Right after the election, people aren't paying much attention to what's going on in Congress, and you have people in Congress voting for their constituents, and they've actually lost their congressional race. Right? The 20th, we had a lame duck session. The second session of every given Congress used to be a lame duck session. And the 20th Amendment to the Constitution got rid of that. And slowly over time, members of Congress and leaders in Congress have thought about ways in which they could protect their members. And one way is to create this new little de facto lame duck session that meets for a few weeks after the elections. And this is so in the last lame duck session, right? This is the lame duck session that dealt with the bailout, right? Bailout politics were too hot for members, you know, in the run-up to the November election. So what did leaders do? They just pushed things off until after the election.
All right, 11:55 here on the wake-up call. Almost finished, but still so much to talk about with our guests today, Professors Paul Friedman and Jeff Jenkins. This is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. And we're here today thanks to the support of L. Oppelman's, Central Virginia's complete music headquarters, continuously operated since 1890. At 909 Main Street in downtown Lynchburg. L. Oppelman's music department now features acoustic guitars, mandolins, banjos, as well as electric guitar packages and complete drum sets. That's L. Oppelman, 909 Main Street in Lynchburg, online at loppelman.com. Professor Friedman, again, we only got like 3 minutes left. You talked about the primary, changes to the primaries. Tell me more about that. I don't hear that in the media.
Sure. Well, we know from recent experience that our presidential election campaigns begin really in the very earliest part of the year in January, February, March, regularly in two states, Iowa and New Hampshire, a caucus in Iowa, a primary in New Hampshire. There are pluses and minuses to doing that. The pluses include allowing small, less well-funded candidates to reach an audience and to gain some level of prominence. But there are a lot of minuses. You've got some really small, very unrepresentative states, and they're the same states each and every time. You entrench particular interests. It's been extremely hard to move, to push until very recently against corn and ethanol, in part because of the role that Iowa has played. So people have come up with all manner of reforms and counter proposals to change the way of starting our primary season. Our colleague and friend Larry Sabato has an interesting set of proposals for dividing up the country into a small number of regions, and then by lottery at the beginning of every election season, choosing one region and a different region to go first. There's some real advantages, and there are real opportunities to think creatively about changing the way
you think
about
that's going to happen at any time?
I think very little of what we talked about today is likely to happen at any time in the near future.
What about the smoke-filled room, Paul? Do you like the smoke-filled room?
Shall we try to return to those days?
Well, you know, again, it's 11:58 and just And I know, Bonnie, you're on the phone again. I apologize. No time to take that call. The show will be podcast. You can go on there and make your comments to that, cvillepodcast.com. Each of you professors, and we'll start with Professor Jenkins, the one change that you feel is most important that you would like to see.
I think something has to be done with the filibuster. I'm not sure you get rid of the filibuster completely, but maybe you limit it to certain topics, certain issues, or you limit its use in a given session.
Professor Friedman?
I think we absolutely positively need to find ways to revisit and reform the way we pay for and raise money for elections.
All right. Gentlemen, thank you so much. I can already tell we're going to be doing this again in the future. I'd love you two as guests. Great topics. We didn't get anywhere near everything on my sheet. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
All right. Next week, we'll be doing talking with the Charlottesville Area Community Foundation. You may not know about them, but they have lots of interesting people and projects that they help make happen. They'll be here next Sunday. Thanks for listening. Drew Thompson up next.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news. On newsstands Thursday, the wake-up call is also supported by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, homegrown since 1982. You can visit Charlottesville's only locally owned and operated chain of convenience stores today. They operate on Main Street, not Wall Street. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or wakeupcall@wnrn.org. The Wake Up Call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in next Sunday morning at 11 for The Wake Up Call, only on WNRN.